comedian Amy Schumer revealed yesterday that she underwent a hysterectomy during the course of a surgery to treat her endometriosis, which had also attached itself to her appendix. It can be an outrageously painful condition, and it seems in many, many parts of the world, diagnoses are very difficult to come by. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Jean Sutton. She lives with endometriosis and is also on the board of the Endometriosis Association of Ireland. Jean, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks for having me on, and thanks for discussing the issue.
We're absolutely delighted to do so. I imagine when you first began experiencing this, you were told it's just period pains.
Yeah, a lot of people have that experience, and they can take up to 9 years, maybe longer, for a diagnosis. I was quite lucky in that I was living abroad at the time in Canada, and I had been missing classes every 3 to 4 weeks. And then I fainted one day. I got my period and just fell on the ground and fainted. And when it came to, I realized I need to go to the clinic. And it was quite straightforward there because of the health insurance. And I knew a lot about my healthcare rights, as, you know, it was part of my visa application. And then when I came back to Ireland, I got referred to a consultant. And that should be the way it goes, that you get a quick referral. But a lot of people, they're gaslit. They're told it's normal. I think everyone remembers in secondary school, you know, girls waiting in the med area with hot water bottles. And really what should happen is if you're having pain like that, it should be medically investigated because it's disrupting your life and that can continue on for decades. And also with endometriosis, it's a really tricky disease. It's associated mostly with period pain as the main symptom, but a lot of people have other symptoms. So it's a really complex, tricky condition with a host of symptoms. And, you know, it's getting the GP to listen to you and refer you on to an expert, because diagnosis can actually only be done at the moment through keyhole surgery. So there's a lot of labour involved, there's a lot of resources involved, and a lot of bureaucracy involved in getting a diagnosis. And that's quite common across the world. You know, there's education and awareness raising, but there's still that kind of, it takes a while to get diagnosed, and there's lucky people like myself who get it quite quickly. But there's a lot of people, it takes, you know, a trip to the GP is quite expensive, and you know, you're doing that continuously, and you might start feeling mental health issues yourself because of this. You're not being believed, the anxiety, the impact it can have on your life and your confidence. I've been very lucky with COVID working from home, actually, because I do get pain still, and it's been easier for me to keep my life, my work life going, but sometimes I've had a few jobs where I've had to call in sick. And this is before COVID, like, you know, work from home wasn't really accepted. But now I think with this other horizon, I'm quite excited about flexible and hybrid work, because it means my life will be a bit easier with it, because there's no cure per se for endometriosis. And, you know, you can be going along fine for a few years and then get hit with it, or you can be dealing with it very badly continuously. Like, some people have 13, 14 surgeries.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
What I find deeply concerning about endometriosis is how long it takes women to have somebody in the medical community actually listen to what they're saying, rather than have them say, I experience pain, and they're not looking at their faces clearly. They're not seeing, you know, the fact that pain is written all over their face, more than likely, when they're sitting in the surgery. And it just seems culturally acceptable in some, but not all, elements of the medical community, clearly, to dismiss that and say, you're fine, go home. And you'd wonder why that persists.
Yeah, and I think a few months ago, the Joe Duffy shows about menopause kind of brought up the same issues, and that it was like, you're a woman, get on with it. I do know that a couple of months ago, the Irish College of General Practitioners did run a webinar for their members on menopause and endometriosis that was organised by Dr. Noreen O'Herlihy. And we had a call with her about it, and, you know, pointed her to a UK body that had done something similar. So there is an appetite for change, but it really needs to be systematic, as opposed to, you know, every couple of doctors, there's a good doctor on this issue, on women's health issues. So, yeah, I do think in Ireland it might be a cultural thing, particularly here with the whole 20th century of repressing things and, you know, not talking about periods. You're seeing a lot more of that. Young people are great at talking about period poverty in particular and openness. Like, workplaces now are having menopause talks. I think that's great. I spoke in my office about endometriosis. I asked, could I do a webinar on it? And I've spoken in a few other workplaces about it, just to kind of highlight how common it is. Like, it's 1 in 10, 1 in 9 is the general estimated. So, like, everybody knows somebody with it. That's how common it is. Like, more and more people tell me, oh, my friend has it, or I've just been diagnosed. I've heard of one woman recently, she was exploring freezing her eggs, and she found out during that that she had endometriosis. I know other people, they've only found out while they've been struggling to conceive. So they find out quite late in life that they actually had it, and they've just normalized the pain that they have up until then.
And literally just gotten on with it. It strikes me when we're discussing endometriosis, Jean, that this is a hidden condition. And we tend to, as a society, have difficulty believing people who have pain that we cannot see, or have a condition that we cannot see. I'm thinking of things like chronic disease. Some people who contracted Lyme disease may have hidden conditions as well. It doesn't always have to be pain related. But we're as a society, skeptical. If somebody says, I am experiencing this, our default position, particularly if it's women, tends to be, are you?
Yeah, and I think with, you know, you see about neurodiversity that it's sometimes diagnosed, misdiagnosis in women because, you know, women are socialized to present that they're together and that they can get on with it. Like, I found in one employment experience I had, I was very much like undermined, and the person kept talking about, well, they had another chronic health condition that's kind of visible, and it was almost like we were having an Olympics of pain. And I was the junior staffer, and I was made do quite a lot of physical work. And I would keep saying, oh, because I was presenting, like, you know, a smiley face front in work, I would be very much like, oh, I actually don't know if I can do that. And then I'd be told, well, it's in your job description. And it made me quite, it exasperated my symptoms. Mm. And nowadays, I would be very firm about, like, the one thing about endometriosis is it impacted the kind of work I do. So we look for desk jobs now. Meanwhile, in my 20s, I was working in journalism and going to a lot of media events. And I opted out of that, like, for a lot of reasons. But a lot of it is the physicality doesn't suit me. And there's no point me working Monday to Friday, going to and fro, and then spending the whole weekend recovering. Because one of the symptoms some people deal with is chronic fatigue. So, you know, there's a lot of, I think, the chronic health community, there's a lot of shared troubles there and shared misconceptions about people across society. But I do think of people talking about it, like Amy Schumer, Lena Dunham talks about Alexa Chung and Molly May from Love Island. People are learning more about it. The media are writing about it more, sometimes not as well as they could, but there is some great public service broadcasting on it.
And Jean, I know that you said at the outset that your experience was atypical, but perhaps shouldn't be. But what are the warning signs that women should say, hang on now, I'm not going to live with this anymore. I need to bring it to the attention of my GP, or go to a different one if they won't listen?
Yeah, what I would suggest is to keep a symptom diary. So to have a diary, maybe use a different colour pen, or maybe buy a certain diary for her, keep it beside the bed in your handbag. And when you have symptoms, write it down, because, you know, stuff like you might think you've IBS, but that actually could be related to the endometriosis. So, you know, there's a list of symptoms online on the endometriosis study website, and also various other places. The HSC website will have one as well. And they're not as typical as you think. Some of them can be shoulder pain. They can be pain when urinating, pain when passing a stool. It's very complex, and everyone has different experience of it. So look up the symptoms, and if you're ticking the box for a few of them, start noticing your body and start knowing it. And when you go to the GP, bring a symptom diary, because that diary actually will help the consultant when you go see them. Because you might have endometriosis symptoms, but there's a few other conditions you could have. Adenomyosis is slightly, it's like a cousin of endometriosis. And, you know, you could have that as well. So, or you could have that and endometriosis, or just that. So there is, it's just keeping a record, and being an empowered patient is an informed patient. Mm-hmm. knowing your options and knowing what treatment options, because you could go to a GP and the GP might say, I'll just put you on the pill. But that's actually not diagnosing the problem, and it's not getting rid of the growth that could be removed during surgery by excision. So it's really important to kind of advocate for yourself. It can be very tiring, though. Like, it is a very tiring thing to be an advocate patient. But, you know, it's about getting the best care for you and being informed and being comfortable with the care you get. Like, don't be afraid to ask questions and don't be afraid to research from reputable websites.
Well, Jean Sutton, thank you indeed for joining us this afternoon, for sharing your experience and indeed that advice. That is Jean Sutton. She lives with endometriosis, but it is also on the board of the Endometriosis Association of Ireland. And you can find out more information on the HSE's website if you wish, or on endometriosis.ie. Now, we're being warned this year to be more prepared for Christmas than perhaps for any other year heretofore because of Brexit and supply chain issues. Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble has been speaking to Conor Pope, who's consumer affairs correspondent and PriceWatch editor at the Irish Times.
Shoppers are being urged to get their Christmas presents early. Yes, I just said the C word. Joining me now is consumer affairs correspondent and PriceWatch editor with the Irish Times, Conor Pope. Good afternoon, Conor.
And a happy Christmas to you too, Ciara.
I absolutely love Christmas, Conor, so I could speak about this any time of year, but many of our listeners will be probably a bit agitated hearing that C word. But
No doubt.
Experts like yourself are saying that the pandemic, Brexit, and the global supply chain issues could lead to shortages of presents. So we want to make sure everybody's happy on Christmas morning.
Absolutely. Now, the good news, of course, is, Ciara, that Santa Claus takes care of presents for children. So parents won't have to worry about that at all. But if parents did want to supplement their child's Santa Claus presents, or maybe get presents for other children, they do want to be looking at it now, because the reality is that there's going to be shortages and there's going to be supply issues in the run-up to Christmas, because we are facing into what kind of could be considered a perfect storm, because you have COVID, you have supply chain issues, you have Brexit, and all of these things are coming together at kind of the time when Irish consumers tend to spend most of their money, because this would be a key 3 months for people. And it's across the board. So, for instance, an awful lot of toys that end up in the Irish market, they come from China. Because of the ship that got stuck in the Suez Canal earlier this summer, the Ever Given, that has impacted on supply issues from China to this part of the world, and then from the containers going back from this part of the world back to China. And that means that there is going to be shortages. There's a huge problem with silicon chips, and silicon chips are, of course, used with everything now, from mobile phones to cars to televisions to games consoles. They're in short supply, so that's going to be an issue. Clothes are going to be an issue, unfortunately, for a lot of people, because it's going to be difficult to get clothes in from further afield. And even food is likely to be problematic. Now, that's not to say that the people are going to run out of food. That's not going to happen. But some of the treats that, for instance, people might like to get from their favourite supermarket mightn't be available as a result of Brexit-related complications.
And so I would assume that would be British supermarkets, is it, Conor?
Well, I mean, the supply chain that has been set up in Ireland, the UK and in other parts of the world, they're all kind of intermeshed and interlinked. So we would rely on a lot of products coming through the UK into Ireland. And in the past, a lot of the time, products would have come from continental Europe into the UK, across the UK, and then over the Irish Sea into Ireland. All of that stuff has been really hampered by Brexit. And then, of course, there's the products that would originate in Britain, and a lot of products are proving hard to find. So, for instance, Marks & Spencer would be one of the big British retailers based in Ireland, and they've said that there's about 800 of their products that they just can't get into Ireland on a routine basis anymore because of complications when it comes to customs and Brexit. And it really is a mess. And the reality is that for all retailers, no matter if they're in food or if they're in tech or if they're in toys, these problems aren't short term, so they will be with us for quite some time.
Yeah, toys and tech, I think, are the two big things that people probably most put on their wish list for Christmas time. You mentioned, obviously, the shortage of computer chips. Would that concern all pieces of technology? As somebody who's not, you know, very educated in terms of the technological world, I have products, but I don't know exactly how to use them all. Does that mean, you know, the iPads, the phones, the laptops, everything like that will be impacted?
You and me both, Ciara. I mean, my knowledge of how the stuff that I have in my hand.
I have it in my hands.
Pretty
exactly.
Small. But the reality is that what I do know is almost every single device that you can think of depends on silicone chips to work. And one of the problems is that at the start of the COVID outbreak, a lot of silicone chip makers would have said, OK, we're not going to sell as many cars. That means we don't need as much silicone. So we're going to scale back production. And then it turned out that the car sales held up. So there was still a real demand for silicone for cars. And that meant that there wasn't enough silicone to go around for iPads, for phones, for, you know, for, as I say, games consoles, for literally everything that you can think of. And I mean, even going right up to the, you know, your fridge, your washing machine, your dishwasher, all of that stuff requires these computer chips to operate. So that's one of the big areas that it'll take about a year or 2 years for production of those chips to be ramped back up to the levels that's required. But I suppose the one thing here, and it's a point that is really worth making, and that's that maybe what we should be doing is tempering our managing our expectations of what we want from the months ahead. Because I think sometimes people just buy stuff because it's available and they think that everybody wants that. But the reality is that we don't actually need as much stuff as sometimes we're guilty of buying. And that comes when you're talking about clothes, it comes when you're talking about gifts, it comes when you're talking about food. A lot of the time we could probably get by very, very happily and very, very comfortably.
Absolutely.
By spending less money. And also the really important thing here, and it's a message that I know we've talked about on the show before, and I know that we've talked about it in the Irish Times, it's one of the ways that you can kind of circumvent the difficulties with the global supply chain is to shop locally and to shop from local producers. Because if you buy local products made in Ireland and by Irish producers, well, then all those global supply chain issues and the container ships going from China to Dublin or all that stuff doesn't matter anymore, because you're buying locally. And not only are you getting good quality products, you're also supporting the local economy and you're supporting local jobs.
Literally just took the words out of my mouth. That's exactly what I was going to say to you next. I know over the course of the pandemic, which unfortunately we're still in to some extent, you have really highlighted Irish retailers across this country with your columns in the Irish Times. And again, just reiterating the fact that if we do shop local, it means that we're not going to be caught up in everything, including things like shipping costs, because that is expected to soar this Christmas.
Well, no, absolutely. In fact, the cost of a this is stuff that you or I would, like, in the normal course of events, this is not stuff that we'd know. And it's certainly not, it's not stuff that your listeners would know. And why would we? Because I don't know how much it costs to hire a container to carry stuff from Shanghai to Sligo. I have no idea. But I kind of know now, because it's been in the news a lot. And one of the problems is that the cost of a container ship, the cost of those big containers that you see on articulated lorries and stuff, it's gone up by 400% in the last 12 to 18 months. Now, an increase of 400% in the cost of shipping is inevitably going to be passed on to consumers when it comes to products. So then not only will we be dealing with supply issues, we're also likely to see prices increase in many areas as well. And we're already seeing that with inflation climbing up to the highest level in more than a decade. I think it's at 2.8% now.
Yes.
And that's something that could be with us, at least in the short term, as I say, this global supply chain tries to sort itself out.
Right, top tips. Shop local. Maybe not buy as much as you think you need, especially when it comes to the food. We know we always have leftovers come Christmas time.
Oh, listen, but not only at Christmas time. We throw out around €700 worth of food every year in Irish homes. So maybe shop less, shop smarter, shop local, and manage your expectations. And ask yourself the question always, do I need this? Is this going to make my life better? Is this going to make me immeasurably happier? And if the answer is yes, by all means, buy it. But, you know, most of the time the answer is, do you know what, I'll be grand.
Well, Conor Pope, the consumer affairs correspondent and Price Watch editor with the Irish Times, you always have so much time for us here. Thank you so much.
No problem at all.
And that was Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble. If you're a woman and have ever thought about entering the political fray, but are concerned maybe that you might not have the skills, that you might not have the backing, that you might not have the confidence, there is training offered by Women for Election to empower you to do that. Joined on the line now by Chief Executive Catriona Gleeson. Catriona, you're welcome to the programme.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Ciara.
Just a little word about Women for Election first. You're completely independent, non-partisan, and the goal is to get more women elected to represent the people of Ireland.
In a nutshell, that's right, Ciara. We're non-partisan, which means that we don't take any sides with any political parties and we're not aligned to any political party. So we're working with women from across the political spectrum and also women who are interested in running on their own independently for election.
And how do you support women into making the leap from that something that they're considering? Because we know that even in applying for a common or garden non-elected job, women won't apply unless they feel they've 80, 90, 100% of the desirable skills, whereas men may apply if they have half of them. How do you convert that confidence and that thought process into actually a woman putting her name forward on a ballot paper?
Well, it's a really good question, and unfortunately we're still in this place in 2021 where women still need a tap on the shoulder to put themselves forward, or, you know, and it's not a specific to a particular generation of women. We're seeing it with younger women that we're working it on in student programs. So what we do is we offer quite a mix of entry points for women who are interested. So we're also reaching out to the public more to ask them to get involved as like that person that puts the tap on the shoulder. And then we're engaging with political parties to look at how they can open up their doors more and how their parties can become more accessible to women who are running. So in our training programs, which is the main thing that we deliver, we offer, I suppose, we look at the confidence piece from the perspective of the barriers that women meet. And our trainers are very skilled in being able to inform, equip and inspire women to reflect on their own skills, attributes and how that's transferable into the political sphere if they're interested in running. So looking to draw out the best of what the individual has and where their purpose is and what their passion is. And then our training also then looks at how people can communicate their key unique messages, what it is that will help them put themselves forward, and that confidence space in that as well, because it's one thing about having the message, but the other is actually having the confidence to step out into more public domains and say that you want to run or put yourself in the running. And then finally, we in our campaign school that we're running next week, starting next week, we also do very practical campaign management. So everything
which is an art in and of itself.
It is an art in and of itself, and which, you know, I suppose there's been a 100-year history of politics, which has been mainly occupied by men. So it's a space that men have been mainly supported to run in, and there's been a natural kind of sharing of knowledge there. So it hasn't always been as accessible to women, although I have to say Kildare is doing much better than most counties in Ireland in terms of the amount of women that are elected. But it's not complacent around that.
Absolutely. I think at the most recent local elections, Kildare returned among the highest proportion of female councillors, certainly as a proportion of the overall number of women that were running for election to the county council here. But you touched on a point, actually, Katrina, that I was going to make. And I know that there are some people listening to you and I have this conversation going, but where's men for election? Where is this facility for men? Where is this training? Where is this support? But it already exists. It exists in the political infrastructure of all of the parties. It exists in the way in which men are groomed. And I use that in a very positive sense, to put themselves forward. It exists in political family dynasties. It's just not called training and it's not formalised.
Exactly. And also, I suppose if we just set the context, unfortunately, about 100 years ago, the great work of Cumann na mBan and all of the leaders pre-1921 and beyond were let down when our state was formed and our constitution created. So the space of politics became the space of men only predominantly. We had six women elected in 1921. It took till the early 90s for that to start changing in Ireland, where we had 20 women elected at all. And we're only at 37 women now. So that's like 31 women more in 100 years. So we haven't had the space where women have had the access to the know-how of the system. And what we're trying to do is get to a balance in politics and get to the place where it's 50-50 in politics in terms of representation. So I would love that we would be in a position in a number of years' time where there's a greater representation of women in politics, and then we're looking to balance bringing more men into the equation. I look forward to that day, but we're a good way off that at the moment.
Katrina, how can women access this training that you're offering, and is it open to all women?
Yes, it's open to all women in all their diversity. We do ask women who are participating to affirm to a commitment to human rights, because we have no place for supporting anybody who doesn't affirm to basic human rights. So that's just the only boundary we put on it. The training is at a low cost of €50 for the 3 weeks of the training. However, we appreciate some women won't have access to those resources. So we have bursaries, free bursaries and scholarships. So on our website, all of those details are there, womenforelection.ie, and people can sign up. We have a range of other courses that run. We have masterclasses. Tomorrow evening, we're delighted to have one of your locals, one of the great leaders in Irish politics at the moment, Catherine Murphy, Deputy Catherine Murphy, co-leader of the Social Democrats. So she's in conversation with Jennifer Bray in an event we run regularly now since the start of the pandemic. So we're
Catherine will have quite a unique perspective, because she has throughout her quite long and storied political career been both a councillor and a TD. She was returned by a general by-election and then by a general election. She is also one of the few party founders who remains active in politics.
Yes, and I'm really looking forward, and if any listeners tomorrow evening, it's a free event, the In Conversation with Catherine tomorrow evening. I'm really looking forward to hearing about that journey more when Jennifer talks to her tomorrow night. And you know, in terms of the work that women, it's interesting. I think a lot of people think there's a lot more women elected than there actually is, because what you tend to see is those women who are elected tend to be more visible, more profiled, because they're working really so hard. So, but actually the figures are so low. Like, you're talking one in every five politicians is a female, both nationally and locally. And Kildare, as I said, is above the national average. So there's 42% of the representatives from across the two constituencies are female, which is what we're trying to get the rest of the country up to and beyond. But I suppose in terms of Kildare, what we don't want is that it drops behind in future elections. So we're really encouraging women to put themselves forward, or if you know a woman, to tap her on the shoulder, because creating this pipeline and pipeline from younger generations up to the oldest woman that's interested in running is really important, and across the diversity of women.
Well, Catriona Gleeson, Chief Executive of Women for Election, thank you indeed for joining us there. And as Catriona said, you can find out more on their website at womenforelection.ie. Just want to read a text that came in after Ciara's piece with Conor Pope, Consumer Affairs Correspondent at the Irish Times. And the texter says, and I think a lot of you will have a bit of sympathy with this, "I would love to do my shopping in my local shop here in the village, but it's just not possible. It's far too expensive. It's the same with Irish products in bigger supermarkets. The price of them is unreal in comparison to the same product that's imported. It's awful. We should be able to buy our own Irish products cheaper. That's where we're going wrong." And I think a lot of people would agree with you, texter. That is the number for your comments, your requests, your dedications. Text or WhatsApp 083 97 97 97. Now, today is World Alzheimer's Day, and I'm joined on the line to mark this and to discuss living with Alzheimer's by Fiona Foley. She's National Coordinator at Dementia Understand Together in Communities. Fiona, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much for having me today.
Absolutely delighted to do so. To mark today, you've conducted a study which I think is quite telling about our evolving attitudes to dementia, and specifically to Alzheimer's. So half of us know a person with some form of dementia. Two-thirds would accept a person with dementia as a close friend. 9 in 10 of us believe people with the condition have the right to be active citizens in their communities. And 8 in 10 believe that there are things businesses can do to make their services accessible to people with dementia. Arguably, Fiona, had that same questions been posed to a very similar group of people even 10 years ago, the results would have been quite different.
Yeah, I agree with that. And when the campaign started, our campaign had a baseline study in 2016, and then we conducted another survey in 2018, and then this survey now in July this year. And we can see that there is definitely a shift in attitudes towards people with dementia, and that people feel more empathetic and understanding of people with dementia. And that is a significant shift for us, because it is very hard to actually shift attitudes. And as you mentioned, like, stigma around dementia is still there. And in the past, it was, you know, many fold from what it is at the moment. And there's still work to do. And, you know, it is important that we realize that stigma can hinder a person to seek a diagnosis. It's, you know, it makes people more isolated and lonely. And they tend then not or to fear to talk about dementia with their friends and their families. So what our campaign tries to do is to, first of all, increase understanding of dementia amongst the general public so that we know how it affects a person and how we can interact with a person, but also then to really inspire everybody out there, whether it's yourself, myself, other individuals, businesses, to take very concrete actions to support a person to stay connected in their community.
I would imagine there's still an awful lot of received wisdom, if you will. It's not quite stigma, but it isn't quite accurate, particularly with regard to Alzheimer's and dementia. And that is that it is a fixed point of experience, that rather than being a spectrum or a continuum of experience, as most people who live with the condition or who love somebody who lives with the condition will attest.
Yeah, you're right there. And, you know, dementia is just the umbrella term, and you have various forms of dementia. So you have Alzheimer's disease, you have vascular dementia, you have Lewy body dementia, and everybody's experience of dementia will vary. And also, as you said, you know, there might be people who have, you know, very at the earliest stages and beginnings of dementia, and it is a progressive disease. So it could take years for a person to, you know, to be at a point where they need more support, and they could still very well be able to work, be able to, you know, participate in community activities, join their local sports clubs, continue playing tennis, all of these things. So it is really important for us to understand that, and that just because a person has a diagnosis of dementia, it doesn't mean that their life changes from that moment on. They can still continue to be involved in community life for a very long time, and sometimes they just need a little bit of extra support from all of us in order to do that.
One of the findings of the study that I did find a little disturbing, and it was that only 2/3 of respondents would accept a person with dementia as a close friend. But on balance of probability, Fiona, it is a person who is already your close friend that will develop dementia. Does that mean that relationships are ending then?
Yeah, what we've seen, and that's where, you know, the stigma comes in as well, is that, you know, a lot of times when a person, you know, goes through the phases of dementia, that, you know, family members or friends or colleagues have shied away because they're just not sure how to engage with the person there. You know, they might be worried about saying the wrong thing. They might feel that the person might not recognize them or might not be able to communicate in the same way. And so you have all these perceptions about, you know, what might happen when you're engaging with your friend or with somebody you know. And so it is important that we continue to see the person and not the dementia, and that we look at what is that person, you know, who is that person, what's their personality, what do they enjoy doing, and also what do they mean to me as a friend. You know, just because somebody develops a condition doesn't mean that I have to shy away and I can't engage with that person. So I think it is that lack of understanding of how dementia affects somebody that really, you know, increases the likelihood of a person shying away because they just don't know how to interact.
Well, Fiona Foley, National Coordinator at Dementia Understand Together in Communities, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, a study jointly conducted by University College Cork and Technological University Dublin has painted the first socio-economic picture of COVID-19 pandemic in Ireland and which communities it affected disproportionately outside of the societal norms. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Dr. Jean O'Dwyer. She's Deputy Head of Environmental Science at a School of Biological Earth and Environmental Sciences at UCC. Jean, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi, Kira. Thanks for having me.
Delighted to do so. This creates a really specific picture of how COVID operated across Ireland and the way in which it affected people based on perhaps the geographical area in which they lived, perhaps their gender, perhaps their age, perhaps the type of housing that they called home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's probably the most in-depth study into such a fine-tuned small area in the country.
And tell us how you conducted the study. Was this through all of the waves that we've experienced so far, the first two, the first three?
No, it's just really from February to November 2020. So the first big, I suppose, wave that we had the data for. So that's what we looked at.
And I suppose the keynote finding, the headline finding, is that people who lived in rural areas in Ireland and those who live in public housing were among the hardest hit by COVID-19. In what way did you find that?
Yeah, so what we did was we took all the symptomatic infections that were notified to the HSE, and we mapped them to a small area to look at specific things. So we're just kind of saying what the data told us. And for hospitalisation anyway, for those admitted to hospital, living in a rural area, for example, was what we'd call statistically significant. So we could kind of predict hospitalisation based on people living in a rural area versus an urban. What this means, I suppose, is just that, yeah, if you lived in a rural part of the country, you were more likely to be hospitalised. But that's for loads of different reasons. You know, it could be that rural areas are a proxy for older people. Mm. So as we know, it disproportionately kind of impacts older people. And then also things like if you're in a rural area and a GP is on the fence about sending you to hospital or not, if you're living very far away from a hospital, a GP might be more encouraged to send you. So there's a lot of different kind of proxies for things, similar to local authority housing. So that could be a proxy for a bit of deprivation or for increased population density, which also kind of increases your likelihood of A, catching it, and B, an increased viral load.
One of the other factors that you found, or one of your other findings rather, was that males are more likely to be hospitalised, admitted to intensive care units, or die. That sounds incredibly stark. Might that perhaps be in some way relatable to how quickly or not, in the general course of events, we imagine that men may seek medical attention?
Yeah, so all of these things have to be taken with, I suppose, a pinch of context. You know, health-seeking behaviour is one of them, although maybe women would be better at it. But across the literature, men seem to be kind of more susceptible to hospitalisation and dying. And there's actually immunological reasons for it as well. So women tend to have a stronger immune system because of having the 2X chromosomes. Mm. So we see that for loads of infectious diseases, not just COVID. And then we wrote in the paper, actually, another one is that men, Joe, tend to be the ones to not wear masks as stringently or wash hands and things like that. So they may be more susceptible to picking it up. Joe, which is borne out in the data then.
And they're quite a significant amount more likely during the study period and of the group that you mapped, Jean. 1.5 times more likely. It's not that there's a hair's breadth between the sexes there.
No, it's a good proportion. And then I suppose if you're looking at the timeline we looked at from February to November 2020, I suppose you also have to take into account that in Ireland anyway, a lot of kind of male-driven sectors would have stayed going longer than perhaps female ones, aside from healthcare. Things like construction and things like that would be predominantly men. So you have to take those things into account as well. But this is seen across the EU and across the globe that men are kind of having more severe reactions to it. And they do generally, for viruses anyway, have a small bit of a weaker immune system compared to females.
Are you aware, Jean, of many other studies which could be comparable to yours, which have been conducted in other parts of the world?
Yeah, there are similar studies that have been done across the EU and in the United States. The United States are probably one of the first ones to do it. And we've referenced them in the paper a few different times. And yeah, they all sound kind of comparable things. The only thing that differs, I suppose, for Ireland, in some countries, asthma was actually protective of COVID-19, which sounds counterintuitive, but because it's a respiratory illness, so you'd think that people with asthma would be more susceptible. But it also means that they're more kind of, if you've asthma, you're more aware of your respiratory health. So you're taking steroids often, so you might have a stronger kind of lungs. But in Ireland, which has a very high incidence of asthma anyway, asthma was kind of stacking the cards against you in terms of hospitalisation. So we differ from some countries in that regard. But a lot of the risk factors that we found here are ubiquitous across any published work.
Now, you're intimately acquainted with all of this data. You've delved very deeply into it. What's your personal key takeaway, Jean, from having conducted this study?
I suppose my key takeaway is that this is something that should be done with all kind of infectious diseases. It's valuable information. Obviously, this is coming out a year after the fact. Data exchange and things like that has to be expedited and shared with the scientific community so we can do these things. But I suppose moving forward, now that we know these kind of risk factors, which we see across multiple infectious diseases, I might add, it gives us better ability to triage correctly. So another thing that was borne out was a BMI over 40 was a very high risk factor. So, I'm sure they are, if clinicians have somebody with a BMI over 40, they should be very precautionary and that these are the people that may end up needing ventilation or may end up a fatality. So it's important data, it's important findings for triage particularly, but also just how we deal with infectious disease data. So you can't know enough about it ever. So we need to do more of this research to make sure that we're developing policy, I suppose, that's effective in managing this should it ever occur again. Now, hopefully we're at the end of this one, but it doesn't appear to be in a lot of ways. So just for moving forward, it's valuable.
Well, Dr. Jean O'Dwyer, Deputy Head of Environmental Science at the School of Biological, Earth and Environmental Sciences at UCD, thank you indeed for joining us.